Welcome to Podcast Against Antisemitism, the show that takes a deep dive into the world's oldest hatred. I'm Ellie, your host, and you can join us for new episodes every Thursday. Subscribe now at antisemitism.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you never miss a show. You can also watch the podcast on our YouTube channel. And please consider leaving us a nice review so we can grow our listenership. It makes a big difference. My guest today is Dr. Barbara Malass, an expert on far-right ideology, online radicalization, and prevention, who works as a research fellow at the Current and Emerging Threats Program at the International Center for Counterterrorism, also known as the ICCT, a think and do tank based in The Hague, Netherlands. In addition, Dr. Malass is the editor-in-chief of Fascism, a peer-reviewed open-access journal, and earlier this year, she appeared as an expert witness at the failed appeal of the notorious anti-Semite Alison Chablos, where she analysed the lyrics of one of Ms. Chablos' songs for the court and explained why the content was anti-Semitic. Dr. Barbara Malass, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm excellent. Thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. No one really asked me that, so I'm doing well. So let's start with this. You know, I think a lot of people hear stuff about the far right, and when you ask, one gets asked to describe it, different people may describe it in different ways. So how would you define the far right?
So I think a way to put it is compare it to, say, conservatism, or, you know, liberal conservatism as we understand it. And that way, by distinguishing it, it's a little clearer, or might be clearer. So if we think about conservatism, we usually would think about parties or individuals that want to or aim to preserve the status quo. So they sort of prevent for more progressive measures and policies to be approved, to get passed. But when you talk about the far right, you're talking about individuals and groups or parties that want to reverse anything that has been done, that further, say, multiculturalism, equality, and that fight against the systematic racism or inequality that we've seen in the past in certain regimes. So the far right, what it wants is to impose and promote, or promote and eventually impose, that systematic inequality that, say, democratic parties would normally do not even question because it's part of the liberal democratic system. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. And I guess what I'm wondering is, because one person hears far right, they may think, oh, they hate Jews. Another person thinks far right, they may think, oh, they hate LGBTQ+ people. So in your opinion, are there any core beliefs that determine what it means to be far right? For example, is it possible to be a member of the far right without being anti-Semitic?
I think it's very difficult because by definition. I mean, and of course, defining any ideology is always very complex. And usually we have case studies in mind that sort of like feed into whatever our perception is of an ideology, a movement, or a user. For example, I would say it's very difficult to find someone who openly endorses far-right ideology and is not sympathetic, at least, to anti-Semitic ideologies, only because the far-right, by nature, promotes difference on the basis of ethnicity, gender, class. You know, difference is the way they understand society should work. And so any sort of categorization that works towards implementing and sustaining those differences is something that they would tend to endorse.
Mm. That's interesting. And I think our listeners may be under the impression that the far right is one big group that gets along. But in fact, there are many disparate groups under the umbrella of the far right, and they often bicker and disagree with one another about the correct approach. For example, while some far right groups prefer to distribute overtly anti-Semitic neo-Nazi flyers, other groups have criticized this approach as being too brash, embarrassing, and doomed to fail, even going as far as to assert that the more conspicuous far-right organizations are government plants sent to bring down the far-right movement. We've also discussed on a previous podcast episode how, with the Russian war on Ukraine, many on the far-right are backing Russia, while some are backing Ukraine, and plenty are disappointed that the two white Christian, I guess, countries are fighting. So why do the far right disagree on so much, and what do they have in common?
That's a very good question, very complex one as well. I think the far right has been very, very good at being opportunistic over time. Whenever there's an issue that mobilizes polarization, it helps them push for whatever their extremist ideas and agendas are. They usually tap on those conflicts or those narratives, and so that they have a new platform to sort of proselytize whatever their ideologies are. So that's why there's so much that, you know, we can sort of pinpoint changes across different circles or far-right groups. Also, especially since COVID-19, we've seen a lot of ideological intersectionality. What we call it that way, but it essentially means that, whatever causes conflict and helps to stabilize democracy and democratic values, the far-right happens to be there. So they adapt very easily. But any of those cases or scenarios, as far as I understand and as far as I've seen, there's a moment where far-right individuals find an opportunity to just put their own agendas at the very front. And then when you identify those agendas and you compare them across different case studies and regions, you see a lot more overlaps than you would see right away. So even though the differences may stand out, sometimes the differences are also strategic choices. So, for example, we've seen this with the alt-right, right? Richard Spencer was really, quote-unquote, embarrassed of those, you know, shaved-head neo-Nazis that were beating up people in the streets because they didn't help sort of purify the image of those that were further to the right than conservative right. And so, you know, Richard Spencer said, let's dress appropriately. Let's try to play the game. Let's, destabilize the system from within. And so that was a strategic move. The fact that he, you know, disagreed or not with whatever those neo-Nazis in the street were doing, then that's, you know, a question we have to pose. I don't think he necessarily disagreed, but he did think it was not useful to the advancement and normalization of our ideologies. We've seen this in France as well. Parties that are playing the democratic game but are endorsing far-right ideologies. And sometimes what they do is legitimizing more radical and more violent far-right ideologies that play a role offline. But they go up the scale of political legitimacy because they still present themselves as, you know, normal, as standard, as part of the system. So in a way, that's the far-right in the last 10 years, I would say. It's been very good, for example, by using, you know, right-wing populism, which is not necessarily far-right, but right-wing populism that has incorporated far-right narratives into their democratic discourse, normalizing the far-right, legitimizing, justifying their violence, but not technically taking action themselves. So that's where, you know, a lot of the difference take place, and that's and related to your, one of I think it was your second question about transnationalism. That's what has allowed the far right to sort of be transnational in a way that a lot of far right circles mimic themselves across different regions. They've only been able to speak to each other by surpassing this sense of collectivity, which we didn't see during the 20th century, for example, right? During the 20th century and before, you talk about nation states, nationalist movements. Now you talk about online movements and an expanded sense of whiteness, solidarity between far-right movements. It is not transnational in the sense that it's not coordinated and it's not as strong as it appears to be. But now there's new meta-narratives that they find that allows for them to have a conversation about, say, common enemies. And that was very helpful during COVID-19. And I'll finish with this. Sorry if I'm going on and on.
It's great.
This issue. But so COVID-19 was crucial because it meant that a lot of people across the world were experiencing the same, were suffering at very relatable levels. So what happened is that the far right took advantage of this by trying to argue that, you know, the enemy that was common was also global. And so that meant that it could mobilize, or, you know, the citizens, the people, quote unquote, the far right could mobilize across different regions towards the same goal, towards the same agenda. And so even though that was relatively true, I mean, we've seen a lot of contact between the freedom movement across Europe and the freedom movement and the freedom convoy in North America. That's happened, but it's happened only on the basis of solidarity. Funding, for example, and mobilization is still very much nation and context dependent. So the far right does tend to go back to the collective that they see as the nation. So that's a very old trope that the far right tends to endorse. But it's seen and it sees the opportunity to talk about, a global phenomenon, because it does give them that advantage of appearing much stronger than before, and giving them a sense of sort of purpose that they were never able to do before to the same scale, especially because they want to take advantage of the only online sphere, which is borderless.
Right, right. Now, I want to ask you about the legitimacy of the far right in the public eye. So I feel like in the 1930s and 40s, in supposedly liberal countries like the United States and the United Kingdom, fascists felt comfortable holding public meetings and rallies and openly marching down the street, even waving flags with swastikas, without really fearing severe impunity. We've seen this with the German-American Bund in the States, which we've discussed on a recent podcast episode, and Oswald Mosley's Black Shirts in Britain. However, it feels as though now, for the most part, it's considered utterly unacceptable by wider society for someone to hold far-right beliefs. And so these people have largely been relegated to the corners of the internet in order to congregate. What changed?
Actually, I'm not sure I completely agree with this. So I do agree for sure that after World War II, there was an utter rejection to anything that had to do with fascism and Nazi ideologies, even though there was sort of like an acceptance of late fascist regimes like Franco in Spain or Salazar in Portugal, just because it was convenient in terms of strategy or political alliances. But I would say that in the 21st century, there's been a gradual normalization of far-right ideologies to the point that maybe when it comes to symbols that directly relate to the 30s, there's usually public outrage. But actually, we've seen neo-Nazi and Nazi flags being waved along, say, the Freedom Convoy in Canada, and nothing really happened because they were either dismissed as crazies or they were not given enough importance, which to me is the same and is as bad, because what it means is that in the end, it's a hate symbol that it's been so normalized. Oh, well, they probably won't do anything about it. They're just angry. People have become a little bit desensitized, and they tend to associate on mainstream platforms neo-Nazi coded symbols, sometimes it's just simply people who are tired of the system, tired of having lost a sense of agency, and want to sort of like bring back the conversation on alternative forms of government. So I think that's very, very bad. And to the point that because the use of these symbols is very much dependent on the context, the flagging and monitoring systems of social media platforms on the mainstream space, for example, tend to skip it. So sometimes, if it's very blunt, they identify it and bring it down or take it down or deplatform it. But sometimes if the context is about, forms of government, or let's talk about fascism as a historical reference, and then you see that behind, if you follow those conversations, it ends up being a space where people can learn a lot about how to, say, convince the public on how to mobilize in order to implement Nazi policies, and I've published on this because I think that we take for granted that this is a conversation that we're so used to seeing that it's okay for it to happen without being monitored. I still think that symbols and even historical conversations on Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and other fascist regimes can become spaces for radicalization. I've seen it. I mean, the data is there for everyone to read about, and that means that I don't think we're paying enough attention to the extent to which the symbols have been normalized and people have become desensitized to them in the mainstream spaces.
Hey, if you want to stay up to date with the fight against anti-Semitism, why not subscribe to Campaign Against Anti-Semitism? Visit antisemitism.org/act or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube. So being honest, how concerned do you think we should be about the apparent rise of the far right?
I think what we should be concerned about is how flexible and resilient far-right ideologies have become, because that means that in terms of, in practical terms, so if you're law enforcement and you're a policymaker and you want to sort of design policies that allow you to intervene more effectively, prevent radicalization more effectively, the problem that they have is that they don't even know what the threat is looking like anymore. So previously, when you had the KKK, for example, you know, very organized organization, very sort of hierarchical, it was relatively easy to follow members, to follow their behavior, to anticipate attacks. I'm saying relatively easy just because there was an organized movement. Today, we're looking at a post-organizational cluster of users who tend to endorse far-right ideologies, but also cherry pick. And conspiracy theories have been very helpful in that phenomenon or in shaping that phenomenon. So what I'm concerned about is that because we cannot pinpoint where the threat is or what the threat looks like, it sort of escapes our ability to react fast enough to prevent attacks that might be inspired by far-right ideologies. I'm not saying consistent, coherent far-right ideologies, but that might sort of like be the last straw for a vulnerable target, for that vulnerable target to act. And so that's what I'm concerned about, that new sort of resilience that I think started with COVID-19 specifically because of the spread of disinformation and conspiracy theories that allowed for those narratives that are, again, not very coherent, but are very useful for the far right to introduce their own very old tropes, anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that we've seen being spread since the beginning of times, almost just being recycled over and over and pushed in and incorporated into these conspiracy theories, because for the sake of it being a conspiracy theory, it allows for as much flexibility as possible because they're non-evidence based. So that boom of conspirational thinking, currently, that's what we do in the think tank like this, ICCT. What we're trying to do is like, what do these conspiracies look like? How flexible are they? So how much can the far right take advantage of it? And what type of threats can we anticipate from it? And we work with the police to do that. But it's very tough work.
Mm. Let me ask you about your work. How did you end up becoming an expert in the far right? Was this a group that you knew you always wanted to research?
So my own background is as a historian. So I actually am an expert in interwar Europe. Yeah. So I've been studying ideology and far-right radicalization for 10 years, and especially symbology and how those symbols can be, you know, used as a radicalization tools and spread among broader audiences. And so looking at history, I started observing patterns of radicalization over time. And curiously enough, I thought the same tropes, the same narratives, the same ideas, the same books just were constantly recycled, depending on the context, but they were there somehow always back in different contexts in Europe and North America. So I started trying to see whether, because I knew those patterns and I knew what type of material was recycled over time, I could help prevent that from happening. So then I started, I consulted a lot for law enforcement, trying to help them identify that type of coded language offline and online for cases of potential violent anti-Semitism or just racism, misogyny, anti-LGBTQI+ attacks. And so based on that, I just ended up in a think tank like this, because that's exactly what they do. Most of us here, if not everyone, comes from humanities, which I think has been very dismissed in general in this field of PCV and counterterrorism. And it's so, so necessary, because most of the radicalization that happens online, especially, is based on ideologies and narratives and communication. And so those who understand how communication can lead people from point A to point B can increase a sense of belonging, form hate communities, hate digital communities, and lead to potentially mobilization. You know, it's very crucial and very key. So for anyone listening who is interested in this, you know, if you come from a humanities background, you're still, you know, very much welcome in this field. We need people like you.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's such an exciting field. I want to ask you about the International Center for Counterterrorism, the ICCT, in The Hague. What has your experience been like working there?
Oh, it's great. It's a rather small think tank, very united, I would say, very collegial. We all come from different expertise, so we collaborate a lot. I'm currently the one that is mostly focused on online threats, but you know, we teach each other, we learn from each other very often, we write together, and so what beyond the work we do, or about the work we do, we usually work with law enforcement and public institutions at the European level, and we try to identify threats and inform recommendations and policies on how to prevent those threats from becoming action, and identifying current threats, which is what I do. So yeah, I would say it's a very dynamic environment that really tries to, very young, really tries to be on top of things and be as welcoming as possible. We usually work with anyone interested in making a difference. So,
oh, no, that's awesome. Now you are, correct me if I'm wrong, you're particularly well-versed in the behavior of the Canadian far right. What does the current iteration of the far right in Canada look like, and what impact has it had on the country?
So, yeah, I looked a lot at Canada just because I lived there during my PhD. So I literally was in the field, but not as much anymore. So, yeah, in Canada, it's been a very interesting case just because no one took the far right in Canada very seriously for a long time. And then we had the Freedom Convoy movement that was supposed to be about, you know, the inability for truckers to take trips to the US to deliver products. So it started like this, but I realized quite quickly that this was becoming quite an aggressive movement against the state. And so I was like, oh, this is definitely going to be capitalized by the far right. And so it happened. I started observing their groups online and realized that users started pushing for, you know, conspiracy theories that were fed with right, far right ideologies that put the democratic values and democratic state at the center of its sort of its target. And then quickly enough, I started seeing swastikas being waved beside these truckers in front of the parliament in Ottawa. So quite scary. Right now, I have not seen much movement going on that front, because I did publish a lot on the subject last year. And I think the police sort of like took measures to sort of try and intervene and prevent violence from happening. But it was quite scary. They really fundraised a lot of money that was seized as well. Even though it fed the idea that, you know, the state overreaches and wants to control. So it was not, it was quite a difficult situation. What I'm interested in now in relation to Canada as well is how Canada, while it was trying to mobilize all those sentiments connected to Europe, including, you know, Sweden and the Netherlands, really, with movements that here are called, in the Netherlands, Farmers Movement, and in Sweden, Freedom Movement. And they started copying the strategies that were used in all of those countries. So for example, here the farmers started taking their truckers and planting them in front of the parliament as well. So that's what Canada did. And so online you saw all of these conversations that, again, you see the transnationality, but are they parallel movements? We cannot really tell. They're not coordinated, they're not collaborating, but they are exchanging ideas on how to strategically act. And the far right was present in all of them, yeah.
Wow, oh my goodness. Now, I kind of want to move on to a totally different topic. So let's talk about Alison Chablas. You appeared as an expert witness at the failed appeal of the notorious anti-Semite Alison Chablas, a case in which Campaign Against Anti-Semitism played a role earlier on. Many of our supporters will be familiar with her. In the hearing, you analysed the lyrics of one of Ms. Chablas' songs for the court. How did you end up becoming the expert witness for this, and what was the experience like for you?
I'm not in a position to disclose in detail how I got that position or that particular case, But I'll say that I have worked before with anti-Semitism cases, and so that was enough for the Crown prosecution to rely on me, which I'm very grateful for. To me, it was a very interesting experience, and it always is like that, isn't it? I mean, I study the far right because it's always challenging, because it's so far from my own ideas on how society should work, that I always have questions, and that's what, you know, makes a researcher wake up every day and work. So in this case, I was very, it was literally a decoding exercise, because the person, the accused, really tried to manipulate the lyrics in ways that, for those in circles that endorse anti-Semitic ideas and far ideologies, would be very easy to identify, very easy to relate to. But that was very interesting for me to sort of find, because it allowed me for me to link the ideas of this person to the intentions of this person and the potential target. So that's what I was trying to put to explain there, that it's not just like using coded language to for humorous discourse or conversations, but actually using coded language to reinforce prejudices against the community that was targeted at that time, helping normalize those prejudices, and so inciting violence against that community. And so one of the arguments that the accusation was sort of pushing for is like, well, only a few people would understand those codes. And as I said before in this interview, that's not true. I mean, a lot of coded language is in the mainstream, and you see individuals repeating it and asking about it. And what it means is that that coded language has bigger exposure than ever. And I'm not saying everyone looking at that coded language will understand what it is right away, but higher exposure means higher chances of getting involved into those type of narratives, which will mean that then it makes you a vulnerable target of anti-Semitic ideology, which could, you know, feed into you becoming a perpetrator in the future. So it was interesting to me, long story short, because it allowed me to understand the extent of what coded language, of how coded language could be used to further this normalization of anti-Semitism in the context of post-pandemic, if we want to call it that way, and how it was justified that, you know, humor should be an enough excuse to spread anti-Semitic ideas, which is something that I have always denied, because even when people joke, this is just, you know, social conduct, when people joke but say something that hurts, they're trying to use humor to disassociate themselves from the content. This is just, you know, quite normal behavior. When you apply this to the spread of ideas that not only hurt but constitute hate speech and potential violence, that is a serious crime and should be taken as that.
Right. And there's, you know, as you know, there's been quite a lot documented about the far right's use of memes and the way they use memes to sort of spread hatred. Now, in the case of Alison Chablaws, it related to a song, a video of the scene of the classic Oliver Twist film when Fagin, a fictitious Jewish criminal, who, by the way, is a character that has come under significant criticism over the past century for its anti-Semitic depiction, is explaining to his newest recruit how his legion of children followers pickpocket and Miss Chablaws. She took the video and she sings an accompanying song of her own about how Jews are greedy, griff for shekels, and cheat on their taxes. And she tried to say it wasn't about this, it was about that. And I thought you did a very good job, because I was there and I saw it, of sort of deconstructing that. I wanted to ask you, you know, it's one thing for a researcher to sort of be doing the research in an office and with the books and the whatever. What was it like actually being in the room with someone accused of this, with an anti-Semite?
Yeah, it was I was a little bit nervous, to be honest with you, because you never know how they're going to view you, you know, like how much do they think that you play into them ending up in prison? So then they can like target you, in the sense they can yell at you. You never know how they're going to react. But because I knew that this would play against her, like any type of behavior, aggressive behavior would play against her, then I didn't expect her to do anything. But that doesn't mean that, yeah, I wasn't slightly worried. I did have actually, how the service worked is that I had support before, just to make sure that I was not nervous, that I was okay. So I do have to be very grateful for that. Really helped. But no, I think it was fine. I also noticed that she was becoming more and more nervous and insecure the longer the day went. So to me, that was a sign that, you know, my arguments were working.
Going back to what we discussed earlier about what defines the far right, it's worth noting that Alison Chablos at one point became a Labour Party member in order to vote for Jeremy Corbyn, which she mentioned whilst taking the stand. She's participated in these far-right circles. I think most people would consider her far-right, but at one point, not too long ago, she was voting for Jeremy Corbyn, who's quite on the left. How does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm actually not sure. Obviously, there might be many reasons for it. I've seen this happen in Spain as well, where far-right individuals would vote for the party that seems to be a threat to the constituted Conservative Party, just to sort of like increase polarization and have a new space to, because I mean, as I said at the beginning, liberal conservatism is not far right, right? So, I mean, you will see the far right trying to undermine it in many different ways. So it could be strategic. It could be just to show that, you know, that she's not far right. It could be a strategic move. I really don't know. I don't have the arguments to, I'm not in her head. It's something that also researchers try not to do unless we have evidence for behavior. So I really cannot tell. But I would say that one action shouldn't determine any conclusion when we have, like, you know, 30 actions that really point to a far right ideology.
Yeah. Now, as we begin to wrap up here, I'm going to ask you a question that I ask all of our guests, which is, if someone who is not Jewish says that they want to help in the fight against anti-Semitism, what should they do?
I think, first of all, always approach the Jewish community to make sure that whatever steps you take into helping them aligns with their beliefs and whatever they think is the right way to go. Because, I mean, ultimately, whatever you do towards helping any community in general, you don't want to appropriate any community goals or community, norms that you might not understand as an outsider. You can always help. You can help anyone, but you have to understand that community and openly make the effort to be as close to that community as possible when acting towards those goals. So I would say that's what we all should try.
Mm. Yeah. Nice. And, finally, please tell the listeners, what have you got going on? What have you got coming up? And where can people find you? If you want to be found, you may not.
No, thanks. Self-promotion is never harmful. So I would say I published a new piece on memes in the post-Brexit sort of online community. And it talks about humor and hate and potential violence. So I would say go find it. I published it with Gnet. So Gnet. And you can find my LinkedIn. I mean, you can search for me as Barbara Molas. And you can also find me on, I guess, the ICCT website under People. And you'll find plenty of links to work that I've published.
Awesome. All right, Dr. Barbara Molas, thank you so much for coming on Podcast Against Antisemitism.
Thank you for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Podcast Against Antisemitism. If you did, please subscribe and leave us a nice rating, or email any feedback to podcast@antisemitism.org. Until next Thursday, stay safe.